My name is Martin Newman, and I'm the consumer champion. After 37 years in consumer-facing industries, believe me, I have seen it all. My goal is to play a role in providing consumers with a voice, to connect with brands that they've engaged with, and to help companies to learn from their customers where they're going right or where they're going wrong. You're joining me on Customer Centricity, the podcast. Each episode, you will find me in conversation with leading business people, discussing some of the key issues around how to empower positive change for consumers and brands. Before I introduce our guest for this episode, let me tell you a little bit more about customer service action. Just like you, I've been on the wrong end of some staggeringly bad customer service. We've all experienced it, haven't we? Whether it's the rude waiter or having to wait 40 minutes in a queue. And just like you again, I've also been delighted by an amazing experience when I wasn't expecting it. But aside from telling the manager or writing a rather awkward thank you note on TripAdvisor, what can you really do when something is great or when it's not so good? My frustration has always been not knowing how to raise these issues with the brand in question in the first place, or whether in fact I'd be even wasting my time by doing so. For these reasons, I launched Customer Service Action, a platform where people can share their good and their bad customer service stories and experiences in one impartial place. My vision is that we can collectively make a difference and create the change that consumers seek, and in turn help businesses too. Good customer service and good customer experience leads to successful brands. So please visit us at www.customerserviceaction.com to learn more. Thank you for listening to Customer Centricity. And now for our guest. Martin, thank you so much for joining me today on my podcast about customer centricity. I'm very grateful for you making some time. Tell me a bit about your background. Tell me a bit about your story, will you?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Martin. It's great to be with you today. So, my background, I suppose the first thing I always mention is the fact I have a disability. You know, it's been a big part of my life and the way I've sort of viewed and experienced the world as an individual has had an impact. But I guess also to counter that it doesn't define me either. It's that sort of balance of it's a big part of my life, but it's certainly not all defining either. So in terms of my disability, it's called spinal muscular atrophy. It's sort of under the muscular dystrophy bracket. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in a wheelchair all my waking hours. I have a hoist that lifts me because I'm not able to weight bear or walk at all. Always need a lot of care support with day-to-day chores and personal care like bathing and showering and stuff like that. And that's been, it's genetics. I was born with it. My first wheelchair was when I was about 3 years old. All the kind of, you can imagine, I sort of empathize the listeners that, if you put yourself in my shoes or on my wheels, that the world hasn't always been designed with wheelchair users in mind. And so those barriers have been problematic. But I guess also my moving into career wise, I started blogging, big passion for inclusion. And I suppose, in the end, looking for the solutions to overcome those barriers so that the world is fully inclusive. And then building on that, realizing that not everyone's a wheelchair user, but the disabled community encompassing, visual, hearing, neurodiversity, hidden disabilities, there's so many of us in the community. Yeah. That I've become a champion, I suppose, and a advocate for inclusion for the whole community as well.
Yeah. I mean, both my daughters have hidden disabilities, so I have an empathy with you and the disabled community. And one of my daughters also has spent a fair amount of time in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I've had firsthand experience of lack of accessibility of many environments. When it comes to different forms of a disability. Talk a bit more about you're the co-founder of Disability Horizons and. You've got an agency. Tell us about all the stuff that you've got going on, because I think it's quite astonishing and I don't know how you find the hours in your day to do all the things that you do.
Sure. So I guess it is sort of building on that personal experience. I did economics and a master's in marketing at uni, 5 years at a disability charity, sort of straight out of uni for the first 5 years in the world of work. And I guess the sort of reason for mentioning both of those is that interest in business at uni, and then that awareness and that passion I got from Scope around disability rights and disability inclusion was to put the two more together than had previously been done. So Disability Horizons is now, as we were chatting about before, 10 years old this month. So that's very much content and stories by the community for the community. So it's very much to disabled people and for disabled people. Mm-hmm. And then after founding that and trying to find different funding and business models, the co-founder Shrim and I had a travel business. And again, sort of that almost sort of incubated from the magazine, because we were learning what the audience was struggling with and what kind of solutions would be well received. Mm-hmm. So we got some social enterprise funding. We then got some angel investment. And then ultimately we sold that travel business to Airbnb. And I think that was the first real experience that mainstream brand like Airbnb was starting to see that disability didn't mean just charity or just compliance and legislative, but actually it's a large group of consumers. So globally, 1.3 billion people, around $8 trillion market annually. It's big business, right?
And I
think that's where things started to shift. Was okay, how can we help lots of brands without having to always do a new tech startup company every single time? So Purple Goat is now a year old, and that's very much that our audience at Purple Goat is business. It's brand side. It's essentially a disability marketing agency, but it's how to help businesses, you know, embrace inclusion and connect with disabled consumers.
Well, and who better to give that advice, right? I mean, if you were a brand that wanted to know, you know, what it means to be accessible and inclusive for the needs of different, you know, groups of disabled consumers, you know, I can't think of anybody better to have that conversation with. Just talking about, I mean, we've also been through this little thing called a pandemic for the last year and a bit that seemed to be never ending, which thankfully, at least from a UK perspective, seems to be starting to dissipate, or at least the numbers are, and we seem to be in control of where it's going at the moment as things start to open up again. Have disabled people been more adversely affected by the pandemic, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some research and stats by people like my old employer, Scope, the charity I mentioned, that it was somewhere around 2/3 of deaths of the pandemic were actually disabled people, which, you know, we know that people with pre-existing health conditions have more susceptibility and problems with COVID-19. So absolutely directly on that health level, there is a correlation around the death rate, or the even just, you know, other people have almost become, inverted commas, disabled with long COVID as well. So it's sort of, you could argue, is almost created disability in a sense. I think socially it's a mixed bag, because I think, you know, as businesses maybe have had to lay off people, that there are instances where disabled people have been the first to go, or, you know, sort of there's already higher unemployment of disabled people, so then it's harder to get, you know, employment within the recession, within the pandemic. But the flip side, a more positive narrative, is that when we've all been locked down, there's actually been more of a level playing field, that many disabled people were looking to study at home or work at home or watch theatre shows from home because they couldn't, you know, for different reasons, weren't able to actually go out and do that. So, yeah, they're, as always, right, there's always mixed kind of outcomes and mixed results.
I think it's a really, really interesting point, and I hadn't thought of that. I mean, you know, I've been talking a lot about the requirement for pretty much all consumer-facing businesses to have a digital and a physical proposition in the future permanently. And I think, you know, because, for example, if you're a gym owner, I don't think you could imagine that everybody that used to be a member that came to the physical environment is still going to want to do that in the future, given that we're many people are going to be working from home, you know, for half the week. And I was on telly a while ago, and I was asked about, there was a a theatre opening up in Tunbridge Wells, and it holds about 3,000 people. And there was only a few hundred that were able to go, and it was great that they were able to go. But I said they could have used digital to enable consumers to engage from home. You know, they could have tied up with Deliveroo or Uber Eats and offered, you know, pre-theatre meals. So, and I think that, you know, to the point you just made there, again, that's something I've never thought of. What a great way for businesses to make sure that their proposition is still accessible to people within the disabled community who, for one reason or another, can't get into the actual physical environment.
And also there's been, we're all aware of the disruption, as you've just sort of, you know, referred to there, that there's a lot more about direct to consumer, even with the sort of Deliveroo and Uber Eats and that world as well. But even in the sort of mobility independent living sector, which is big, like I gave the numbers earlier about the market size. So as disabled people and older people have gone to the local high street mobility store, you know, for home adaptations, all that kind of stuff, there's a massive need to disrupt that to be more digital as well. So even within the sector, the sort of older ways are dying out. And I think we've all heard that the pandemic kind of sped up what might have taken 10 years into a year or two. And I think lots would agree, lots of it has been a positive disruption as well.
Yeah, definitely. Just coming back to you specifically, what's your own lived experience of being disabled when it comes to engaging with different brands? Talk to us about some of your own frustrations.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one example is I've always loved travel. So in fact, when I left Scope, again, it's sort of 10 year, there's a big thing going on in my life at the moment around lots of things that happened 10 years ago. So I left that safe day job to start the magazine and the consultancy and all the things I've gone on to do. But part of the reason was so I could travel more. And I was also blogging at the time and, you know, just literally trying to go abroad, the difficulties with getting on an aeroplane when I have to be assisted and lifted by a couple of airport staff, the risks of the wheelchair being broken, putting it in the hold. I mean, air travel is a bit of a nightmare when you've got a mobility impairment like myself. And then you get to the other end. Is there an adapted vehicle with a ramp? Has the hotel got a wet room, shower, and obviously basic, you know, wheelchair access? Mm-hmm. So I guess in many ways it's around the provision of information is one big point, that if there isn't any, you're pretty stuck. But if someone's, you know, got curated or got that information out, that's more helpful.
Yeah.
Obviously in the first place, having the provision of accessibility as well. Mm-hmm. I don't ever feel like brands were really seeing and understanding that need. It was maybe more from that compliance place. It was, they'd done the things they were meant to do by law, but they weren't courting, for want of a better word, disabled consumers. But then as I started traveling, and someone else passed away a few years ago, but a real legend of accessible tourism called Scott Rain said, accessible tourism is adventure tourism, because it literally was so hit and miss as to what would happen or what would go well or not go so well. But ultimately, by blogging, I ended up getting invited around the world, and I was really lucky to see all these amazing places through my blog. And it was through that point that some of those travel brands and tourist boards started to get the business case. And I think thankfully the last sort of 3, 4, 5 years we are seeing a bit more of that education and awareness from brands.
Isn't it amazing though? I mean, you talked about the incredible number of consumers, or people should I say more importantly, globally, who have some form of disability, and what the value of that community is. I mean, I think I'm right in saying in the UK we're talking about roughly 14 million people who have some form of disability. And you know, in terms of the impact that they have, you know, I think I picked this up on Purple Goat and your website, that families with disabled people spend £249 billion a year.
Yeah.
Why is it that businesses don't see the business case? Why is it they're not looking at the commercials? Why are they in the main still doing the bare minimum to tick a box? I don't get that.
I think there's a few factors that I've come across. So I think historically, disability was more, there was something we called the medical model that was trying to cure the disability or the health condition, and otherwise it was very segregation. So schools and, you know, independent living, they're all very out in the countryside, away from society. So for like my grandparents' generation, you just didn't see or meet disabled people. And then as sort of things picked up 70s, 80s, there was a bit more around independent living and some government policy that was more, you know, empowering of disabled people. But it was also then a big rise in the charity model. So we saw the telethons and the fundraisers and, you know, obviously the work that a lot of the charities did and do is fantastic, but it's undeniable that the public message of please donate for the poor disabled people that can't do X, Y, Z also has quite a negative stereotype of what it is to be disabled.
Yeah, of course.
And then I think the third part is there had to be a lot of political activism in that sort of 70s, 80s times. And so a lot of brands, it's either haven't even thought about it, presume charities have got it covered, or are scared of engaging with disabled people because if they get it wrong, they're going to get shouted at for doing it wrong. And they're all the things that Purple Goat, we're helping both brands, but I think the disabled community as well, to like, it's 2021, let's do this in the future together now.
Well, I think they're going to be shouted at even more if they don't do it at all.
Or and that's another factor, yeah.
They don't embrace it. I just don't understand it. I do on some level. In the context that there's lots of things that businesses are facing into at the moment, like social responsibility, diversity, which is often thought of from an ethnic perspective, but in my perspective is much broader than that, because in my mind, you know, the disabled community is a core part of that diversity and diverse communities. And you know, if it were me and I were running a business today, you know, I'd want somebody with a disability on the board, you know, because I'd want a board of directors that were representative of the customers that I want to sell to, because then you've got a better chance of making sure that all those different cohorts and communities of customers are their needs are being, you know, being taken account of. Do you think there's something in that?
Yeah, I mean, to take, you know, it's easier for me to refer to my almost segment within the community, if you like, so being a wheelchair user. So of the 14 million disabled people in the UK, 1.2 million are wheelchair users. So if I was on a board of a supermarket or a bank and able to say, have you thought about this within your product or your customer service or your marketing or your employment and your recruitment?
Exactly.
You know, imagine how that could shift the needle of how many more wheelchair users would become not just customers, but loyal, happy customers. That's serious, you know, that moves the bottom line, right?
Yeah, totally. And that's my point. You know, I think having that representation at the right level in the business means that the business is always going to be on top of it and is always going to be, you know, focused on it. But there's such a, you know, commercial, and there's a more, in my mind, there's a moral imperative for a business to do this and cater for the needs of, you know, whether it's less advantaged or disabled consumers or whoever it happens to be. But there's also a very, very clear commercial imperative. Yeah. And I think it's the second part that I'm not sure that they, you know, in a general sense, fully get at the moment. So apart from having somebody, you know, at the board, have you got any other thoughts on what a business could do to make sure that it was being accessible to everybody, you know, universal, inclusive design, that sort of scenario? Any advice on that?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental tenet of it is having the voice of disabled people nearby at all times. So whether you're designing a new product or, as I said before, the kind of, you know, recruitment processes, the marketing, I think it's just having a variety of disabled people that can give you those insights and steer everything you do. And I think we have to be very careful that it's not to have different diversity groups or even just customer segments almost pitted against each other. Your point there about universal design is the overall point here. But I think for so long, of all the different stakeholders and research initiatives, brands just haven't thought about speaking to disabled people and families of. So it is just having that voice and those insights included in all of the DNA of your business.
Yeah, because just on that note, I mean, I've you know spoken to quite a few visually impaired people who have guide dogs and they've not been allowed access into a retail business. And I mean, that's against the law, but isn't it? I'm pretty sure it's against the law.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the big thing with the law is about reasonable adjustment. So that's where sometimes upholding the Equalities Act gets a bit grey area because of what is reasonable or unreasonable. But I think with the guide dog, if it's someone needs it to live their everyday life, it's absolutely a reasonable adjustment.
Totally. But the reason, I mean, the reason why that happened in the first place, I don't think it, you know, I don't think anybody, you know, in a senior role in the business has said we must not let people in, you know, in with guide dogs. That's just somebody on the front line who actually thinks they're doing the right thing, not letting a dog into the store rather than fundamentally doing the wrong thing as well as breaking the law. Doesn't that just come down to training and you know, making sure those people on the front line are very aware of what all the policies are?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is all about education and empowerment. So in a way, it is still similar to that overall tenet of having the voice of disabled people everywhere. That should be included in the HR learning and development, that there isn't a tick box hour of like general disability thing. And of course, you want a bit of, you know, the stats and the history, it's all very helpful and interesting, but you then want to actually just bring it right down to the nuts and bolts. If you're working in a store, how do you empower those staff members to feel confident and comfortable? I think there was a story last sort of autumn, probably back end of the summer, where a disabled person and her sister were at Alton Towers and they were sort of kicked off a ride. And it was exactly that same thing, that the person working there just didn't really know how to act, what to say. And they were not being horrible, but they were doing what they felt was safer and better. But it made the headlines, and it was, you know, it didn't do a lot of good for Alton Towers' general brand. And so, it is that empowerment. And I know they've done a lot now behind the scenes at Alton Towers of, okay, how do we really, really support our staff rather than just give general information about disability?
Yeah. I think the key word you used there, and I've heard you use it a lot throughout the conversation already, is empowerment. And we're very aligned on that. And, you know, I very much believe that, you know, to be customer-centric, irrespective of who your customers are, it is 100% about empowering your own people to be able to serve customers to the best of their ability.
Absolutely.
And engage with them to the best of their ability, as it is as much about empowering the customer to be able to engage with the business in the way that they want to. And that's ultimately, you can pretty much boil it all down, you know, to that, can't you really? It's so much to do with all of, you know, with that on both sort of sides.
Yeah. I was going to say, and connecting that back to the business case, there was a bit of research done called the Clickaway Pound, and that was a bit more to do with digital accessibility. So you could, particularly if someone is blind or vision impaired and not having the right digital accessibility, I can't remember the stat, but it was millions of pounds are lost because you're not empowering the customer. But it's exactly the same in store, that if you're not empowering your staff to then empower the customer, you're basically going to lose business. And I think we're now in a world, I really do feel there's a parallel of the sort of green brand and the sustainability brand movement. In the next 10 years, if you're not, and we use the color purple a lot for disability, if you're not a purple brand, you don't just lose out on that opportunity cost of disabled consumers, but I think mainstream consumers will be gravitating to the businesses that are looking after everybody.
Totally agree. I think to be successful, you know, now and in the future, you know, I think you have to show true empathy Yeah. And, you know, you need to be a purpose-led business and a values-led business.
Yeah.
Not a value-led business, a values and purpose-led organization when it comes to sustainability, diversity, you know, the purple pound and so on and so forth. I fully agree. And I think it will, you know, it will affect, you know, how many communities view your business if you don't look after any marginalized group.
Yeah.
Or certain cohort of consumers, irrespective of who that is. Again, we're very aligned with that. One thing I wanted to ask you about your own business, I think I'm right in saying that it's a very small percentage of adverts feature disabled people. I think it's something like 0.06%. And yet, again, that doesn't add up. So 0.06% of adverts feature disabled people, and yet nearly 25% of the population of the UK has some form of disability. Yeah. Albeit, I appreciate some of those are hidden disabilities, as in the case of my daughter's, but it obviously doesn't add up. Your agency helps brands to market more effectively to disabled customers. What does that support entail, and how can you help businesses that clearly don't, again, get this stuff to do it better?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's shocking, isn't it, that disparity. And I think, you know, what I've experienced and seen in my life is disability has always been the sort of poor cousin of diversity and inclusion. So the civil rights, the political rights, and now the business case as well. It's actually bigger numbers of disabled people than a lot of the other sort of minority groups or protected groups. But yeah, far less awareness and provision. In terms of how we support, I guess we're, you know, the more we're doing now, we've done some amazing campaigns for Tesco, Starling Bank, Highways England, lots of really interesting conversations going on with really big tech brands at the moment as well. Wow. And in the end, it's just boiling it down into the representation part. So how do you get disabled people, disabled stories as part of your general marketing, your general brand awareness, just to have that representation? The second part is what actual features, and it will vary on the brand and the particular business, obviously. But, you know, in many cases, there are often things that are of particular benefit or use to disabled people. So when that's the case, you can then drill, like with Starling Bank, you know, there's a lot of benefits to that type of banking for a lot of people with disabilities, that sort of on your phone, not having to go to a branch, all that kind of stuff. So you can look at the actual features as well there. And then the other part, I suppose, is around actually improving the product and the offering that a business has. And we try not to scare the brand too much with that at the beginning, because there is that fear we talked about earlier when we were chatting before. But ultimately, you know, inclusion is a journey that we may never arrive at, because the world's always changing. There's always things going to be have to be tweaked and improved upon. But I think it's like there's low-hanging fruit of representation working all the way through to what new products and services or adaptions of products are needed by actually quite large numbers of disabled people that are not even being catered for.
When I'm looking at the future, so I'm getting my crystal ball out and I'm trying to think of a more positive world, which I do believe we are moving towards. I look at the politics globally and I think politics are changing and maybe things become a little bit more center ground again, which is a place where I personally feel a bit more comfortable. And I think that as we do that, and as we talked about consumers moving more towards, well, generally everybody moving more towards being more inclusive and more thoughtful, and brands becoming, you know, more purposeful. I look at Gen Z, or as they call them in the States, Gen Z, and millennials. And I feel very positive because I have two of them at home. One who is 20 and is an absolute archetype Gen Z. You know, she is a kind of, you know, mini version of Greta Thunberg. And then my older daughter is on the cusp of being of Gen Z and millennial. Do you think, because when I look at them, I see them beginning to create some very positive change for all of us for the future, particularly around, you know, the climate and the environment, sustainability and everything. Do you see them potentially also playing a big role here for the, you know, the rights and creating a better world for disabled customers or disabled people? And if so, what might that entail? Do you think, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess some of that talk around millennials and Gen Z does come into social media as well, right? They're sort of, they're separate, but they're very overlapping. And I think, you know, for me, the reason there's more opportunity for disabled people to be included across the board in society is that social media is given a platform, given a voice, given a way to build connection and community and all that good stuff. But obviously there's the other side of social media where it can be a bit toxic and a bit negative. And I think that that's a bigger conversation that we're all trying to work out, how, you know, places like Twitter can have constructive conversation, not just toxicity and all that. That's a bigger view. But I just mention all that because I think TikTok has become a really interesting place for creativity, for social issues. And like some of the influencers that we work with at Purple Goat on different brands have done some amazing, like on the Tesco, for example, some amazing, you know, content. And it just resonates and goes down so well with that, those two cohorts you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think there's just sort of that awareness and awakening, almost, if you get a bit spiritual about it. But there really is this feeling that younger generation just want the world to be sustainable and inclusive to everybody. And I agree with you. I think the future looks a lot brighter than it's maybe felt the last 10, 20 years with the politics and all the stuff going on.
Exactly. Let's hope so. And a lot brighter as well, as we hopefully come out of the pandemic for once and for all, albeit we know we're going to have to live with COVID, and some of us will get our, I mean, I get a flu jab every winter, you know, so I'm sure I'll be getting my COVID jab every year as well, but I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Hopefully the rest of the world, including the poorer countries, can get their fair share of vaccines and we can all come out of this together, because we need that, don't we? We all need to be moving in the same direction on this. I certainly miss my travel, so I need to be on a plane and going to some other places and not just staycationing for the rest of my days. Martin, in the face of incredible adversity that the majority of us never have to worry about, you have achieved so much. And, you know, not only in terms of, you know, being a vanguard for your community and a torch bearer and a flag carrier and somebody who is pushing forward the needs of your community, but also the change that you're making in the world by doing that and by educating brands on how to provide more accessible environments and how to understand the different, you know, cohorts within the disabled community that they're needing to serve more effectively. I take my hat off to you. I think it's fantastic. Long may you continue to do that, because lots of people need it. And just thanks again for taking your time to be on today and share all your insight.
Pleasure, and thanks so much for your time too, Martin.
My pleasure. If you would like to know more about what we're doing at Customer Service Action, the platform where people can share their good and bad customer service stories and experiences in one impartial place, then please visit customerserviceaction.com. Please remember to subscribe on your favourite podcast app so you can be notified when we go live with future episodes. Thank you so much for joining us today on Customer Centricity with me, Martin Newman.